25-year-old Sasha Lee Shaw was building an incredible life for herself and worked her way into a good job in which she was securing her financial future. The future was bright. But by 2021, one part of Sasha Lee's life was less secure. Her already unstable long-term relationship was crumbling under the weight of devastating revelations. And Sasha Lee called it quits. Her ex-boyfriend, though, was not ready to let go. And he would soon take actions that would destroy countless lives and leave a grieving mother fighting for justice. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 203, The Murder of Sasha Lee Shaw. This episode is sponsored by IntegriSure. I talk about some of the most serious crimes on this podcast, but crimes like smash and grabs and house break-ins happen much more frequently, and accidents happen too. As a podcaster and freelancer, I rely heavily on my laptop and phone. If something happened to them and I wasn't insured, it would be a huge problem. Plus, you'd all definitely be asking where the next episode is. IntegriSure has been operating as one of South Africa's top short-term insurance brokers for almost 30 years. And I know that as I've gotten older, I've definitely felt more of a need to protect what I've built through hard work with a broker that understands me. IntegriSure doesn't just do car and home insurance, though. They also think about the stuff you probably wouldn't even consider until you need it. Road and home assist, advice from experienced brokers, and a range of value-add products like pet insurance. Because somehow, Fluffy always seems to get into it with the neighbor's cat when the budget is already tight. We all try to be intentional about protecting ourselves, and that should definitely apply to your choice in insurance brokers too. Visit www.integrisure.co.za to connect. IntegriSure, car, home and business insurance for the generation that does not take chances. IntegriSure is an authorized financial services provider. True Crime South Africa is an independent podcast and relies on listener support to keep going. There are many ways you can support the podcast. You can check out all of them at truecrimesouthafrica.com. The most impactful way is by joining the Patreon community. Patreon members get free access to TCSA events, exclusive episodes, discounts on my audiobooks, and ad-free episodes. So you don't have to listen to me say this every week. You can join the Patreon community from just $2, around 32 rand a month. And if you aren't big on commitment, not only is there a free 7-day trial, but you can also cancel at any time. New Patreon supporters get a shout out when they join. Listen through to the end for that. Patreon.com/True Crime South Africa. Please. And thank you. I connected with Jessica Naidu through the True Crime South Africa Facebook group. Since my book Bare Bones and its Afrikaans translation Klipkoot came out, in which I write about 10 unsolved cases which have either been reopened or received new leads or developments after being published on the podcast, I've noticed a huge surge in requests from families for assistance in their cases. This case is technically not unsolved. We know what happened and why, but there is still an element of outstanding justice. And in this case, Jessica didn't directly ask me for assistance. I commented on her post in the group and asked if it would be helpful for Sasha Lee's case to be covered on the podcast. Since then, I've had the honour of getting a little glimpse into this deeply grieving mother's battle to see the completion of justice and to have her daughter's unnecessary death become slightly less futile by hopefully helping and preventing future victims. I'm going to repeat some of the following in the body of this podcast because I know not everyone listens to the intro, but my sources for this episode are all legal documents which are in the public domain, including the transcripts of the inquest held into the death of Sasha Lee Shah. Any mention I make of culpability in a crime is supported by the inquest findings and approved by the NPA for public release. As you will hear, I also had the great honour of getting to know Sasha Lee through her mom, Jessica. And in the bits where I usually tell you about the victim, Jessica will provide a lot of that information in her own words. This episode is a little different from what you're used to, but I can absolutely guarantee you it's one of the most important episodes I've done in a long while. So let's get into episode 203, the murder of Sasha Lee Shah.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information in our show notes.
Sasha Lee Monique Shah was born on the 8th of December 1996. As Jessica's first child, her milestones were diligently tracked. The first time she laughed, turned onto her tummy on her own, and her first word, dada, were all noted down along with a photograph of Sasha Lee as a baby. For most parents, these milestone records become sweet mementos to share with their child as they grow up and perhaps have their own children. For Jessica Naidu, it became something that she would share with people reporting on her daughter's murder. Because Sasha Lee would not make it to the point of building her own family. Instead, 4 years after her death, her mother sits down with me on a Zoom call, and with a level voice that belies the torrent of emotion bubbling just under the surface, she introduces me, and you, to Sasha Lee.
My daughter, Sasha Lee Monique Shah, was a very quiet and a gentle and a deeply compassionate young woman. She was soft-spoken by nature, but carried a quiet strength within her. She didn't need to be loud to be noticed. Her presence alone could light up a room, and even when speaking, people felt her warmth. She had a soft and kind spirit. She was loving, loyal, and incredibly thoughtful. At home, she helped with everything. This is from the time she was a little girl. As little as a toddler, I used to put a duster in her hand and let her dust the furniture. She used to take out the carpets and dust them outside while I cleaned the inside. So as she grew, she loved cooking, cleaning, washing. And she did all of this in the home while she was studying. And the one time I was unwell, so she took care of me without hesitation. She must have been around 17 at the time. And she took pride in everything that she did, no matter how small it was. And she carried herself with grace. She was well presented. She always did her own hair and her makeup. If you look at her social media or any photographs that you would see of her, she loved the Indian attire, the Eastern attire, her lehengas, her Punjabis, and she would always do her own hair and makeup. And she was a woman of integrity. She was grounded in strong morals and values, and she was honest. And for me, all this is very important when raising a young lady. She was very strong-minded. She was intelligent, and she knew who she was. She didn't follow the crowd. She only spoke when she was spoken to, but when she did, it mattered. She was a young lady who hardly came out of her room. We had a big home, and sometimes I would see her in the kitchen, and I would say to her, "It's nice of you to join us." That is how quiet she was. She would spend most of her time watching movies, reading, studying. And from a very young age, she showed remarkable ability. She was artistic and talented. She had won many art competitions, color in competitions. And she used to love to bake. And when she baked, she would bake anything from biscuits to cakes, and she would decorate them. So I think because she was so artistic, she loved whatever she presented to be artistic as well. She could put together a 1,000-piece puzzle in just a few days. She loved playing the guitar, the piano. She owned these instruments. She loved the violin, the drums. She was also very passionate in everything that she did. And everything that she made was not just beautiful in terms of what she baked, but it was also very tasty. And for me, what stands out is her chocolate truffles. Those were my favorites. And one of the most special memories I have of my child is when she was in grade R. Her brother, her younger brother, is 3 years younger than her. So he was at home at that time. And every day after school, she would come home and she would teach him what she had learned in school that day. So every word from the minute the teacher spoke till she left, she would sit him down in front of her chalkboard and she would become his teacher. She was very patient this way. She was very nurturing. And that led on towards her school days where she would help teachers mark exam papers, and they would call her to help with these chores at school. She excelled academically throughout her schooling career. So from grade R right to matric, she took most of the subject awards. And she was also very active in sports, particularly swimming.
Jessica is here today advocating for her daughter. And when you hear everything she's been through to get some justice for her child, it becomes clear that this woman is deeply committed to her children. And this isn't the first time Jessica's had to advocate to ensure fairness for Sasha Lee.
So when she was writing her matric exam, she got something called Bell's palsy. And her face was paralyzed on the one side. It just happened randomly one day. And I remember being at work and she called me and she says, "Mom, I'm at the doctor." And that was quite shocking to me because this child wouldn't even get the common cold. And so I left early and I went to meet her at the doctor and I was told that she has Bell's palsy. And being the mom that I am, I'm very, very particular. I did a little bit of research on Bell's palsy and I found that during this time of Bell's palsy, your eyes can dry up. So I took the necessary precautions and I ensured that her eyes did not dry up. But unfortunately, everything that I did didn't help. She ended up with keratoconus and she had to then have 2 corneal transplants. So she wrote her matric exam with very limited eyesight. I had to apply to the Department of Education to increase her writing time and to increase the font on the exam papers. That is how she wrote a matric exam. And she passed the matric exam and she gained a college entrance into UKZN Westville campus.
Bell's palsy is a condition that causes temporary facial paralysis or palsy. It usually only affects the muscles on one side of your face. You may have a lopsided smile or an eyelid that you can't fully close. It rarely affects both sides of the face. Bell's palsy happens when there's inflammation and swelling of your 7th cranial nerve. That's the nerve that controls your facial muscles. Certain conditions, like viral infections, can cause inflammation. But many cases of Bell's palsy have no clear cause, and it can affect people of all ages. Most cases of Bell's palsy go away on their own with time, as Sasha Lee's eventually did. When Jessica and I were chatting after the official part of the recording, I mentioned to her that all of the people I'd heard about who'd had Bell's palsy were also very high-functioning individuals. You know, the so-called type A personality people who push themselves to succeed at everything they try. Of course, there's no scientific basis to that, except that stress and sleep deprivation are common triggers for Bell's palsy. But I've heard a ton of stories about super achievers who are suddenly struck with Bell's. And this really made sense for Sasha Lee too. because in addition to what you've already heard about her, Sasha Lee truly did put everything into anything she did and generally achieved what she set out to.
In addition to her academic achievements, she underwent security training, obtaining her grades A to E certification. This was because she worked for the Fidelity Group and wanted to better understand the security industry she was part of. But more than that, she wanted to understand the people around her, the roles they played and the realities of their jobs, including the security officers who were employed within the organization. She never saw herself as above anybody, and there was no sense of pride or superiority, only a genuine desire to learn, to understand, and to respect the work of the others around her.
Up to this point, Jessica has kept her emotions amazingly level. She's clearly an incredibly strong woman who should never have had to be this strong for this long. But as she describes what a truly wonderful person her daughter was, her voice cracks and she needs a brief break. We are being introduced to Sasha Lee through her mother. And honestly, I am in awe of the fact that Jessica is even able to string a sentence together. But here she is, eloquently telling the world about who Sasha Lee was and what we all lost.
She made a conscious effort to familiarize herself with all of the aspects of the fields, especially as she had exposure across all 16 subsidiaries within the organization. This reflects how seriously she took her role, her personal safety, and her future. And a month before her passing, she told me that she was working towards becoming a chief operating officer of an accounting firm. She had big dreams. She wanted to travel the world one country at a time. She was driven, she was focused, and she was deeply purposeful. She has a file where she's printed out the countries of the world and she's highlighted them and written on those pages which country she would like to visit and when she would like to do it. She had already begun building a life for herself. She had her own vehicle, her own money and savings, and a clear vision for her future. She dreamt of owning her own home and exploring the world, experiencing life beyond borders. She was kind and deeply respectful. Her humility was one of her greatest strengths. And no matter how far she was going in life, she never lost the gentle and sincere person that she was at her core. She loved the simple things in life. She enjoyed eating chutney, fried chips, noodles, Nando's, and especially McDonald's. She could eat McDonald's every day. She loved the skinny chips. She was disciplined and lived a balanced life. She managed her time very well. She went to gym daily. She studied on her own without being asked. She helped at home and she worked. Her life was very structured. She was very focused and full of intention. And family meant everything to her. She loved deeply. Her baby cousin, Oswin Reddy, brought her so much of joy when he was born. She left everything to go and visit him. And she carried him. And I say this because she was not a person who carried babies often. She would be a bit scared. But when he was born, she carried him. She played with him. She was well-mannered, respectful, incredibly disciplined. And she made many sacrifices to achieve her goals and never allowed obstacles to stand in her way. So she was my firstborn child, my only daughter, and my pride and joy. She was not only a sister to her younger brother, but she was also a guide and support to him. She excelled particularly in maths and accounting, and she worked tirelessly to build a future for herself. Sadly, her father had passed away years before she was murdered, and from that point on, I had raised my children as a single mother. I did the best I could to guide and support them. I was a strict mother, but I always did it with love and intention. Education was very important in our home. And I made sure my children understood its value. I wanted them to have discipline, direction, and opportunity to build a better future for themselves.
Whenever I speak to the families of murder victims, I ask them to go back as far in time as they're comfortable doing, and then work their way forward to the moment that brings them to my podcast. I do this for two reasons. Because I deeply believe that victims of violent crime deserve to be known for much more than the way they died. And also because very often, if you start with the worst moments, you'll never get back to the best parts. So much about what Jessica has said so far has painted this picture in my mind of who Sasha Lee was as a human being. She was kind, generous, loving, deeply committed to her studies and then her work, and pretty much every parent's dream child, taking what her parents had instilled in her and the sacrifices they'd made, and making a better life for herself. When Jessica mentions that her husband, Sasha Lee's father, passed away when she and her younger brother were relatively young, that fills in more of the puzzle. Experiencing such deep grief so young changes you. And I'm certain it made Sasha Lee only more committed to making her father proud in memory. It also explains the tigress I've met in Jessica, the mother bear willing to go to war for her children. Because for a long time, she was all they had, and she had no choice but to step up in her own grief and be both mother and father to her children. The human being that Sasha Lee was at 25 was a testament to the fact that Jessica succeeded in her quest to ensure that her children had the best possible start in life. And so we find ourselves at the point in Sasha Lee's life where things began to shift. It actually started before she turned 25. In fact, the person who would end up taking her life was a friend of Sasha Lee's from high school. Kyle had wanted to date Sasha Lee back then already, but Jessica, in her mama bear manner, insisted that her daughter finish matric before she involved herself in any relationships. She acknowledges to me that they probably hadn't heeded her warning, but the relationship only became publicly official after Sasha Lee matriculated. Before I get into the events that would lead up to Sasha Lee's murder, I want to clarify a few things. Firstly, I've just mentioned Kyle for the first time by name. I have not said his surname, although it is easy enough to find. And I will also refer to him as little as possible by name for the rest of the episode, because both Jessica and I agreed that this episode is going to be about Sasha Lee, how her life was taken, and what needs to happen now to ensure other victims do not die for the same reason she did. For legality's sake, I will say that all of the information I'm about to give you has been taken from inquest transcripts, statements from the NPA, copies of protection orders filed with the SAPS and relevant magistrates' courts, and email communication between Jessica and various departments. All statements I make and labels I apply are supported by the findings of the inquest held into Sasha Lee's death. And I have a documented directive from the NPA stating that these details are in the public record and may be released. Where there are specific statements I make regarding crimes which have been confirmed as committed or alleged as committed, I will refer back to the inquest magistrate's findings for each statement. Finally, before I proceed, I would like to acknowledge that Kyle's family has also suffered deep grief, and I extend my deepest condolences to them too for their terrible loss. Sasha Lee and her boyfriend at the time both worked in the security industry. Sasha Lee was on the corporate office side, and her boyfriend worked as a security guard. Things between the couple had been rocky for some time. And while it would be unfair to speculate as to the nature of those difficulties, we know that in October 2021, Sasha Lee discovered that he had been cheating on her. This fact would be confirmed by several sources, but it is also a fact we can confirm through public record, as the woman who he'd been seeing had ended up taking out a protection order against him. Sasha Lee knew nothing of that at the time, though. She only knew that there had been infidelity, and for her, this was a deal breaker. She broke up with him, and in her mind, the relationship was over. This is not the story we often hear of one individual giving another one too many chances. This is, however, unfortunately, the story of one individual who refused to accept the ending of a relationship. Between October 2021 and September 2022, Sasha Lee experienced an ongoing campaign from her ex to get her back into a relationship with him. She held fast that entire time, but was beginning to struggle under the weight of it. By September 2022, Sasha Lee had made a decision that she didn't want to have to make, but felt she had no other choice. And on the 22nd of September, she applied for and was granted an interim protection order against her ex-boyfriend. I feel incredibly privileged in this case to have access to all the documentation that Jessica has given me, because I can read to you from the protection order application. And in Sasha Lee's own words, we can hear her reasoning and what she was experiencing. It's rare for us to have the deceased victim's own words about their experience. So I'm going to read you exactly what she wrote. The form requires the applicant to, quote, give full details regarding all incidents of domestic violence and also indicate whether firearms or other dangerous weapons were used, what injuries have been sustained, and whether medical treatment was obtained, end quote. In this section, Sasha Lee writes, quote, my ex-boyfriend has refused to break up with me. He sometimes physically abused me when I was with him. He has emotionally abused me for a very long time. When I told him it's over, he threatened to kill himself with a firearm and said it will be my fault. His recent physical abuse was when he slapped me hard on my face and I couldn't hear properly for 3 weeks. He emotionally abuses me by bringing up bad things from the past and accusing me of fake events. When I blocked him off everything, he could still contact me from an unknown number and called me almost 100 times a day. He then gets new numbers to message me from. He stalks me and sometimes waits outside work to follow me back home so that he can take my phone and force me to come with him to get it back. He parks outside our house, refusing to leave to see if I'm going anywhere and with whom. He has pictures of me that he threatens to blackmail me with if I don't date him. He is the only one who has it, and I will charge him if it is leaked. He borrowed money from me and promised me to pay it back, but I always have to ask for it. And he says he'll only give it back if I'm with him and he feels that he's okay with giving it back. I am very scared of his threats and behavior. He is always threatening me when I don't say yes to him. He has various threats every day. End quote. Now, just a reminder. Those are not my words. Those are the exact words of Sasha Lee Shah in a formal statement which was viewed by a magistrate and declared as sufficient basis to grant an interim protection order. Yes, the individual would have had the opportunity to respond to or refute those statements before a permanent order of protection was passed. But the process would never reach that point. In that statement, I see several forms of abuse highlighted. Psychological and emotional abuse. Financial abuse. Physical abuse. There are threats of abuse through the publication of private photographs. I also see coercion and threats of violence. The next part of Sasha Lee's statement is perhaps the most heartbreaking. In the next section, the form asks for information regarding the urgency of the application. Sasha Lee writes, quote, "I cannot live a normal life with continuous stalking and threats from this man. I do not know what he's capable of, as he has a firearm. My family and I feel very unsafe because he parks outside our house and I have no father to assist. He tries to contact me every day, and just yesterday he kidnapped me and told me that he will make a very big scene if he doesn't get to see me or if I get a new boyfriend. I fear for my life every day with his threats. I insist on an interim order so that I may be protected as soon as possible, as he is very unpredictable and I don't know who he will hurt if he doesn't see me." End quote. This is what Sasha Lee Shah was living through in the last year of her life. She broke up with him in October 2021. And by September 2022, this individual had still not accepted that she was not going to get back together with him. As a professional person who had worked incredibly hard for everything she had, this level of interference in her life had to have been an absolute nightmare. As part of the conditions of the interim protection order, because the individual owned a firearm and had threatened to use the firearm to commit violence and or self-harm, the magistrate ruled that the SAPS must seize the firearm for the duration of the interim protection order. This is pretty much standard practice in such cases, if there is physical violence and the individual is known to possess weapons. Once the protection order is heard in court, if it is affirmed and made final for a stipulated period, the firearm will remain in the custody of the police. If the interim order is cancelled, then the firearm must be returned. On the 28th of September 2022, an SAPS captain served the interim protection order to the individual, and he signed for its receipt. And it is at this moment that things went very wrong. What the captain failed to do that day was complete the second part of their duty, and that is to remove the individual's firearm. This was never done, and he remained in possession of it. Sasha Lee and her family, however, were informed that service of the order had been made, and it was now in force. The individual was not allowed to contact her or physically approach her at her home or her workplace. Understandably, the Shah family would have believed that all of the terms of the order had been fulfilled, and his firearm had also been securely put into the SAPS's custody. But that was not the case. The court date to hear the protection order was set for the 3rd of November 2022. But there would be no hearing. Instead, on Sunday, the 30th of October, Sasha Lee had gone with three friends to Gateway Shopping Centre in Umhlanga. One of the friends, who I'll refer to as Miss R, testified in the inquest that would follow about what happened that day. She said they arrived at Gateway around 4:15 p.m. and they went to go get some food at a fast food restaurant. Ms. R noticed that while they were eating and chatting, Sasha Lee's cell phone pinged, and when she looked at it, her expression changed. Eventually, Ms. R asked Sasha Lee what was wrong, as she had become very quiet and withdrawn from the conversation. She said that her ex was contacting her again and wouldn't leave her alone. Although Ms. R was very familiar with what had been going on with her friend's ex, the other two friends were less well known to them, and it was clear Sasha Lee didn't want to discuss her troubles in front of them. Ms. R said that when it was time for them to leave, Sasha Lee suddenly seemed hesitant to go outside. They did eventually walk to her car, though, as she was going to give Ms. R a lift home. The pair said goodbye to the other two friends, and Sasha Lee got into the driver's seat of her car. Miss R had opened the passenger door, but had not yet gotten in, when movement across the parking lot caught her eye. She looked up and saw Sasha Lee's ex moving toward the vehicle. She saw that he had a gun in his hand. Ms. R bent inside the vehicle and told Sasha Lee that the individual was approaching her car and he was armed. She asked if she must run for help, and Sasha Lee looked at her and nodded her head. Ms. R set off in the direction that their two friends had gone, and as she did, she heard Sasha Lee's ex say something to the effect of, "Oh, so you're with him now?" She told the inquest court that she'd believed he'd been referring to one of the male friends they'd been with, and he'd assumed Sasha Lee and him were dating. She reached the friends and called them back, but just as they turned to walk back to the car, they heard a single gunshot. They then started sprinting to the entrance to find a security guard when they heard many more gunshots. And finally, one single shot again. And then silence. Ms. R watched from a distance for a moment, and as soon as she realized the gunman was down on the ground, she ran toward the car to check on Sasha Lee. I have no doubt that the scene she found there will never leave her memory. Mall security arrived quickly and called in backup, as well as police and an ambulance. But when paramedics arrived, it was clear that nothing could be done for either person. Sasha Lee had never left her car. The perpetrator had simply approached, shouted that question at her, and then opened fire. She had been shot 6 times. The perpetrator then turned the gun on himself and took his own life. And from this point, I will be referring to the individual who shot Sasha Lee 6 times as the perpetrator, as was legally defined, determined, and confirmed in the legal inquest into her death, and as confirmed as accurate and correct in writing by the regional communications manager for the NPA in KwaZulu-Natal, Natasha Ramkisan-Kara. The gun the perpetrator used to shoot himself and Sasha Lee was found next to his body at the scene. It was sent for ballistic testing, and although there was no doubt, it was confirmed that his gun had fired the bullets that had killed Sasha Lee. When I have as much information as I've been given here, I don't ask family members to do things like tell me about getting the phone call that changed their lives or what that felt like, unless they offer that information up for a specific purpose. I don't really understand the value in questions like that. The human brain protects itself from trauma, and often loved ones only have a very hazy memory of getting that phone call anyway. And to ask someone, "How did you feel when you got that call?" feels pretty pointless to me. What do you think it's like to get the call that your daughter, who spent the last year desperately trying to live a normal life while pretty much being hunted, has now had her life taken on what should have been a very ordinary Sunday afternoon trip to the mall? Utter devastation and disbelief does not begin to even touch the edges of that experience. But Jessica and her son did receive the news that late afternoon. In the inquest, Ms. R testified that she'd called Jessica to let her know what had happened while she was still on the scene. When the scene was processed, it was determined that the perpetrator's car was parked not far from Sasha Lee's. Inside the vehicle, police found evidence that the perpetrator's actions had not been a spur-of-the-moment decision. The perpetrator had packed some of his most treasured possessions into the back seat of his car, and he'd written a suicide note. In the note, he designated which items should go to which people after his death, and he signed off with a rather strange line, in which he said that he'd like to thank a specific police officer, who he named, but I will not name here, for all their help. With this evidence in mind, it becomes clear that the interim protection order had done very little to stop the perpetrator from stalking Sasha Lee. He had still messaged her that day, and for him to know where she was and to park just a few parking spots away from her car, he had to have been following her, even though she hadn't realized it. It's not at all uncommon, unfortunately, for protection orders to actually trigger a perpetrator into action, which can turn deadly. It's not a reason not to apply for a protection order, of course, because these orders are important parts of the paperwork trail to prove ongoing harassment, abuse, and stalking. But they are, after all, only worth as much as the individual who is tasked with obeying its order. And in this case, became only as useful as the SAPS officer who served the order and was tasked with complying with its conditions, including promptly seizing the firearm, which just a few weeks later was used to kill the two people who its seizure would have protected. And I say this because the perpetrator's family was also let down here, as their loved one used that very same firearm to end his own life. Sasha Lee was laid to rest in an emotional and heartrending funeral. Jessica forwarded me some of the slideshows that were played on the live transmission of the funeral, and I can only imagine the raw grief that must have been tangible in the air, as all those who loved Sasha Lee witnessed some of their memories with her playing out before them, with the absolute knowledge that they would never again create any new memories. Although the funeral would have been hard enough for Jessica and her family, the day after the event, she was contacted by a man who would provide her with information that puts an entirely new lens on what had happened to her daughter. Again, I want to reiterate that the information I'm about to share is supported by sworn statements and documentation, including issued protection orders and SAPS case documentation. You'll remember I said Sasha Lee had broken up with the perpetrator in October 2021 when she discovered he'd been having a relationship with another woman. Well, what Sasha Lee didn't know is that the woman he'd been having an affair with was almost killed by the perpetrator, and a case of attempted murder was opened against the perpetrator at that time, with the charge later being downgraded to assault with intent to do grievous bodily harm. The father of this young lady contacted Jessica and informed her of this the day after Sasha Lee's funeral. And when Jessica started digging a little deeper, she discovered that there had been other infidelities and other similar cases and charges like this against the perpetrator. In May 2021, a case regarding gender-based violence involving the pointing of a firearm at a woman was registered at Phoenix Police Station. Also in that year, another protection order was issued against the perpetrator by yet another woman for domestic violence-related behaviour. In the first registered interim protection order, the applicant made the following statements on her request for the order. Quote, "He refused to stay away from me. He kept coming to my house. And when I refused to go out and see him, he made numerous threats via calls. One of which was that he would knock me if he had to see me with anyone. He threatened to shoot any other guy he saw me with. He is currently in possession of a licensed firearm, which he pointed at my face while sitting in his car on the 21st of September 2021. Aside from pointing the firearm at my face, he held it to his head and in his mouth many times, attempting to harm himself. He stalks me to this day and harasses me via calls." End quote. I'm sure I don't have to point out the pattern of behaviour here. What this victim experienced is almost identical to what Sasha Lee reported experiencing. and the use of the firearm is explicitly reported. Sasha Lee's interim protection order was the fourth complaint received and lodged within the justice system regarding this perpetrator in the space of just over a year. He was already a known risk for serious violence against women, and he had already pointed a firearm at a woman in May 2021. Every single one of these cases was handled to some extent by Phoenix Police Station and would have been under the ambit of the same captain who served Sasha Lee's interim order to the perpetrator and failed to secure the firearm he had already pointed at another woman and he later used to kill Sasha Lee and himself. The SAPS had four opportunities to remove this firearm, and they failed to do so on each and every occasion. This captain was at the time the head of the Phoenix SAPS's domestic violence unit. I will note here that this captain is not the same officer who was referenced in the perpetrator's suicide note, although that officer was also a member stationed at Phoenix SAPS at the time. After discovering this horrendous set of failures, Jessica laid a complaint with Phoenix SAPS against the captain involved. An internal inquiry was held, and the captain was found guilty of an act which brought the service into disrepute, as well as contraventions of the Firearms Control Act. The captain was suspended without pay for 2 months and would be allowed to return to service on the 27th of May 2023. While this action is certainly an important part of the greater landscape of justice for Sasha Lee, it still raises one big question. If this happened in this case, how many other similar failures had resulted in ongoing pain and suffering, or even possibly death, for other victims? And is it happening again somewhere in South Africa right now? On the 19th of March 2024, an inquest was held in the Regional Court for KwaZulu-Natal in Durban into the death of Sasha Lee Monique Shaw. In South Africa, an inquest is a judicial investigation into unnatural deaths, governed by the Inquests Act 58 of 1959. It is a court inquiry, not a criminal trial, aimed at determining the deceased's identity, if necessary, their manner of death, and whether there is prima facie evidence to hold anyone accountable for their death. These proceedings are designed to establish truth, reassure the public, and prevent future deaths. And that last part, of course, would be incredibly important in Sasha Lee's case. Jessica attended the inquest. First, Miss R gave evidence about what had happened that day. The first officer on the scene then described what he had seen when he arrived and how he had handed over the investigation to the detective later that day. Warrant Officer Alan Supersad then testified as the investigating officer in the case. He spoke about how all of the required testing and inquiries had been done as part of the unnatural death investigation, and he had identified the perpetrator as the one and only suspect involved, confirming that it was his findings that the perpetrator had shot Sasha Lee and then turned the gun on himself. In addition to the three witnesses, there was also CCTV footage, which had captured the crime. Sipasad also confirmed that he had become aware of the interim protection order when he received the case, and that he'd noted that the order had specified the perpetrator's licensed firearm should be removed upon serving of the order, and this had not been done. He further confirmed that the same licensed weapon had been the murder weapon. The following is an excerpt of the magistrate's findings. Quote, "The deceased in this matter was shot dead, So she was murdered. The elements of murder include the act, meaning the criminal act as conduct that causes the victim's death. Such act could be carried out with a weapon, a vehicle, or the person's bare hands. The conduct must be undertaken voluntarily and cannot be as a result of a failure to act. The perpetrator must have the criminal intent to commit the offence. The act must be unlawful. In this instance, it has been established that the act of murder was committed by the conduct of K.I., who acted unlawfully with the intent to kill Ms. Sasha Lee Monique Shaw, end quote. And also, quote, the gunshot wounds were inflicted by K.I., thus committing a criminal offence. The court, after considering all the evidence brought before it in this inquest, finds that K.I. is criminally responsible for the death of Ms. Sasha Lee Shaw. K.I. shot the deceased and thereafter shot and killed himself. End quote. Please note that in the magistrate's finding, she had used the perpetrator's full name, and I've abbreviated it to his initials. The magistrate also discussed the raised culpability of the SAPS member, who had failed to remove the firearm. The captain had not been subpoenaed to testify in the inquest. However, they acknowledged that there existed a requirement for criminal charges to be considered against the SAPS captain, and instructed that the transcript of the inquest be forwarded to the Director of Public Prosecutions for them to make a decision as to whether anyone should be prosecuted in the matter. Jessica would have left the court that day with two things. She had an official record of exactly what had happened, with legal confirmation that her daughter was murdered and who the perpetrator was. And also, she had an inkling of hope that the Director of Public Prosecutions would see that there was a case to be answered by the police officer in question. Unfortunately, the wheels of justice would require some assistance to get going, and after waiting almost a year with nothing happening, in April 2025, Jessica initiated criminal charges against the captain herself by opening a case and later escalating this to the IPID and provincial police. On the 17th of November 2025, Jessica was advised in writing by the National Prosecuting Authority that the matter had been referred to the Director of Public Prosecutions, following a recommendation by the Chief Prosecutor of the Ntuzuma Cluster. The DPP indicated that the case involved novel and complex legal issues with no directly comparable precedents identified in South African law. A special panel had been constituted to assess the matter, and further investigation by the IPID was required before a final prosecutorial decision could be made. They indicated that the matter was receiving active and careful consideration. Then, on the 4th of February this year, Jessica received another email confirming that the DPP had decided to arraign the captain in the regional court on the following charges: contempt of court or failure to comply with a court order, and culpable homicide. The step that would follow this to bring this matter to court would be the issuing of a summons to appear. After having received the confirmation in February, Jessica has made numerous inquiries as to the progress of the case, and the DPP has responded, informing her that there have been some delays, which appear to be administrative in nature, but they've also told her that they cannot share some of the delay issues because they're confidential DPP procedures. As at the release of this episode, although there is no good legal reason why proceedings have not gone ahead, the case remains in limbo. It will certainly not be the first time an SAPS member has been charged with culpable homicide or related charges for their actions while on duty. It will be the first time that an SAPS member is charged for not having removed a firearm when they were instructed to by a court in a domestic violence case, which then led to the victim's death. The case in its entirety is unprecedented and will set a legal precedent for future cases of this kind. This is no longer just about Sasha Lee. It is about every victim of domestic violence, men, women, and children, who have sought protection from the SAPS and the courts, and in turn been failed and ultimately killed by their abuser. I can think of at least a dozen cases just off the top of my head where this exact situation has played out. It is not rare. It was not a bad day at the office, in my opinion, and it must be addressed. Protection orders are already really just pieces of paper. Yes, you are legally backed by being able to call police should the perpetrator violate the order. But at the end of the day, it's not a bulletproof vest. So for an already relatively weak protection mechanism to be further weakened by having its conditions not carried out to the T is a violation we cannot stand for in a country where our levels of domestic violence and family murders skyrocket every day. There's one other thing I'd like to address before I get into what else we're looking at here in terms of justice for Sasha Lee. If you've heard of this case on any other platform, you may be aware of a range of other issues which have occurred which I've not addressed here. None of those are pertinent to justice for Sasha Lee, but they have made Jessica's fight for justice a lot harder than it should have been. I've done my best to keep us on track with the real issues here, and I've also done my best to be as respectful as possible to the other individuals who have experienced loss and grief around this. If you've listened to my podcast for any amount of time or follow the podcast social media platforms, you'll know that I protect the victims of violent crime who choose to share their stories with me with everything I have. I do not tolerate victim shaming or blaming in any form, and it will be no different in this case. There has been far too much loss and pain already across the board, and I think we can all agree that the case, which hopefully will soon be presented in court, will go a long way to strengthening accountability by the SAPS for victims of domestic violence in South Africa. And I can't imagine why anyone would not want that. And that brings me into the final part of what justice and legacy for Sasha Lee, Monique Shah, and all victims of domestic violence by firearm could look like. For the last year or so, Jessica Naidu has been developing and campaigning for a change to South African law, which will help to protect future victims of domestic violence. She has coined the name the Sasha Lee Justice and Firearm Accountability Act, which I will refer to for ease of reference as Sasha Lee's Law. Jessica shared some of the presentations she's done around this proposal, and they are incredibly well thought out and cohesively presented. Sasha Lee died as a result of two things: the perpetrator's obsession with control, and the consistent systemic failures which enabled his actions. We can do nothing about the former now in this situation, but we can certainly do something about the latter. By having Sasha Lee's law implemented, Jessica hopes to ensure that firearms are removed without delay in all domestic violence cases, and also to ensure that officers who fail to carry out this duty are held accountable in a criminal and disciplinary context. Jessica has proposed that Sasha Lee's law will fit into the Firearms Control Amendment Bill, and she's even identified where it would fit into the Firearms Control Act 60 of 2000. It will become Section 102, and the first part reads as follows, And I've summarized this to make it less legalese to listen to, but you can be assured that Jessica Naidu has gone full legal eagle on this. Quote, obligation to remove firearms upon protection order. Whenever an interim or final protection order is issued under the Domestic Violence Act 1998 or the Protection from Harassment Act 2011, the South African Police Service must A. identify all firearms and ammunition in the possession, custody, or control of the respondents. B. seize and secure said firearms and ammunition within 48 hours of service of the order, unless otherwise authorized by a court. The SAPS must notify the complainant or applicant in writing within 24 hours of removal of firearms, including details of all items seized and the location where they are held. End quote. Reading that, it sounds so fair and so logical that it's almost hard to believe it's not already part of our law. Then Jessica proposes that Section 102B govern the criminal accountability of responsible officers. Quote, any SAPS officer who willfully or grossly negligently fails to comply with Section 102A commits an offence and is liable on conviction to A, imprisonment for a period not exceeding 10 years, or B, a fine, or both. For the purposes of this section, grossly negligently includes failure to act within the prescribed 48-hour period or failure to verify possession or seizure of firearms as required. End quote. Jessica has also included the necessity of internal procedure continuing alongside any criminal action taken against the officer in what would be Section 102C. And then in Section 102D, she makes a suggestion which I believe would make interim and permanent protection orders far more impactful. Under court enforcement, she recommends, quote, courts granting interim or final protection orders must include specific directives for firearm seizure, referencing sections 102A to 102C. The court may A. set deadlines for compliance, B. request written confirmation from the SAPS of firearm removal, and C. order additional measures if the SAPS fails to comply, including referral for independent oversight review. End quote. Jessica's proposal has, for the most part, been well received. She participated in the dialogue session on the Firearms Control Amendment Bill held on the 4th of December 2025. The day after her presentations, she received communication from the Chief Director for the State Law Advisory Services in the KwaZulu-Natal Office of the Premier, Mr. Heinz Kuhn, confirming that Jessica's proposal would form part of ongoing discussions, which at the time the director indicated would restart in February this year. On the 19th of December 2025, the Deputy Director General for Court Administration, Department of Justice, Mr. Lucky Moholaba, made contact with Jessica to indicate his willingness to discuss her proposal. And finally, Mr. Velenkosini Khlabisi, Minister of Cooperative Governments and Traditional Affairs, also made contact with Jessica to indicate that her proposals were being shared with the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development, Mr. Kubayi, in light of gender-based violence and femicide having been declared a national disaster. It is all looking very positive. But I think Jessica knows, as well as I do by now, that words mean very little until action is taken. Changing the law is not a simple overnight procedure, nor should it be. There are, of course, lots of stakeholders to consider when assessing the proposal of Sasha Lee's law. But I do hope that everyone keeps in mind that the most important of those stakeholders are the victims and their families. I've met and worked with some incredible police officers, And I still believe that the vast majority of SAPS officers do this very difficult job because they truly want to make a difference. I don't know why this failure happened in this case, and why, by virtue of the guilty finding in the internal hearing, we know that this officer did not do their job. But I do know that the officers I've dealt with would think that this is incredibly poor, and they would want action to be taken to ensure it never happens again. And while the captain in question has been found guilty internally, they will still need to answer to criminal charges. And I can understand that for many police officers that might be a scary thought. But this is not a matter of a police officer making the wrong decision in the heat of the moment. It's a pattern of gross negligence. And when you take on the mantle of an officer in the SAPS, you understand that while negligence for a grocery store packer might be the wrong price on the wrong product, for an officer of the law, negligence like this is the difference between life and death. I fully believe in supporting our police members and lauding them when they go above and beyond. But I equally believe that accountability is vital. I have the honor of meeting lots of different types of people in this work I do. And the families of the victims of violent crime in South Africa come in all shapes and sizes. I will say that I don't know that I have ever met a grieving mother who is quite as formidable and incredible as Jessica Naidoo. As she spoke about her daughter, and I got to know Sasha Lee, I thought, wow, this was such an amazing, strong, smart, determined young woman. What a force she would have been in the world. And then, as I got to know Jessica, my thought was, okay, well, that's where she got it from. Sasha Lee was, and would have been, an incredible force in the world. And really, she still is, through her mom. And that force can be multiplied tremendously, if we all get behind her too. As we wait for the wheels of justice to turn in both the criminal case and the lawmaking process for Sasha Lee's law, Jessica Naidoo is going to need an army behind her. She will need each and every one of us who has ever looked at a case of intimate partner or family murder by firearm and thought, someone should do something about that. To help her to be the person who does something about that. I will ask Jessica to continue to update us on both the criminal case and Sasha Lee's law. And I'll put any updates or requests for assistance on True Crime South Africa's social media pages. For now, if you've never shared an episode of True Crime South Africa before, please share this one. We need as many people as possible to be aware of the failings that occurred in this case, should they find themselves in such a situation. And we need as many people as possible to put their power behind this shift for change. You know, I always sign out with something about the victim. And in this case, I have Sasha Lee's mom to do that, because she truly says it far better than I ever could.
So Sasha Lee was a remarkable young woman, intelligent, driven, full of promise. And her life was one of purpose and quiet excellence. Her life was tragically cut short at the age of 25. She was murdered in cold blood by her ex-boyfriend. Despite taking legal steps to protect herself, the failure to act, particularly by the law enforcement, is central to this tragedy. This is not just the loss of a daughter. It's the loss of a future leader, a compassionate human being, a young woman who had so much to give this world and this country. And I'm not seeking vengeance. I'm seeking justice. Justice for my daughter, Sashalee Monique Shah. Accountability for the failures that led to her death. Because her story is not just her own. It represents every woman in South Africa who relies on the system for protection and every family who trusts that their loved ones will be kept safe. Her life mattered, her voice mattered, and her story must never be forgotten.
Sashalee Monique Shah. Rest gently. For more victim-focused true crime contents, please follow True Crime South Africa on the app you're using to listen right now. I also have another podcast you might like called I Lived Through This. Follow the podcasts on social media platforms for updates on new episodes and other crime-related stuff. If you'd like to support the podcast and grab some True Crime South Africa branded merch, listen up. CCSA has partnered with the SA Criminologist platform. And if you head over to their website now, you can stock up on a wide range of true crime-themed merch, including tumblers, stickers, pens, mugs, and so much more. And if you use the code TCSA at checkout, you'll get a site-wide discount of 10%. Check out the full range of true crime-themed merch at sacriminologist.co.za. And support TCSA while grabbing some truly cool goodies for you or your partner in crime. I'll be back with another episode before you know it. Until then, thank you so much for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.